This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, George Pelicanos, is a crime writer with a cult following. His characters are steeped in pop culture. His private eyes see the world through music, movies, and TV shows. Pelicanos sold audio and tended bar before becoming a writer. He's now a partner in Circle Films, the company that produced Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, and the current film, Whatever. Pelicanos' novels are set in Washington, D.C., where he grew up. His latest, The Sweet Forever, takes place in the mid-80s, after crack has transformed Washington. The main character, Dimitri Karas, who's Greek-American, manages a small chain of record stores owned by his African-American friend, Marcus Clay. Dimitri is always trying to cover up his increasingly heavy consumption of cocaine and alcohol. The plot is set in motion after a car carrying drug money crashes in front of one of their stores. Here's a scene in which Dimitri, with a girlfriend Donna, goes to check in on the Georgetown store he manages.
They kept walking. They passed Commander Salamander, where rich kids from Potomac and McLean came downtown to get their hair dyed pink and buy their bondage punk look from the middle-aged proprietors. Well, thought Karas, at least the kids are having fun. Everyone these days is having big fun. Karas could deal with Georgetown, the lack of parking, the panhandlers, the gimmick bars serving lousy draft beer to Northern Virginia kids on weekend nights, the suburbanites in the crowds, the Iranian and the Iraqi merchants selling off-brand clothing and shoes, the jewelers pushing gold chains to the drug kids driving in from across town. Marcus Clay couldn't deal with Georgetown, so this had become Karas's turf by default. You needed a record store in this part of town if you wanted to be in the business in D.C. The demand for music was big down here. 2 years earlier, a monstrous crowd had pushed through the plate glass window of Kemp Mill Records during an in-store appearance of Frankie Goes to Hollywood. That same year, when a rumor surfaced that Prince had been seen window shopping on M Street, scores of purple-clad kids had descended on Georgetown in hopes of spotting his royal badness. Yeah, Marcus hated G-Town, but Karas never tired of reminding him that Wisconsin & O was his top-volume store. Karas went into the store. Donna Morgan stayed out front, lit up a smoke. The store was narrow and deep, generally unclean and dimly lit. The new Falco, Rock Me Amadeus, boomed from the stereo and pumped the house. The manager, Scott, greeted Karas right away with a handshake and a smile. "Hey, Dimitri, what's the word?" "Johannesburg." Scott was on the heavy side, his face acneed from junk food. He wore his shoe-polished black hair short, except for the thick lock that fell in front of his face. Marcus had complained about the look, and Karas had shrugged it off, saying it was a flock of seagulls thing. Marcus had said, "A flock of douchebags, maybe. Tell him to get his hair on out of his face."
Thanks for reading that, and that's a reading from George Pelicanos' new book, The Sweet Forever. Do you feel that there are ways that you are departing from the traditions within the crime novel and the private eye novel?
Yeah, the main thing is that I write about working-class people who get into some situations with crime, but their particular stories are small. These are not Washington novels about the general putting his crazy finger on the red button. They're about the guys that work in the bars and kitchens and the warehouses around town.
In the record stores and the audio stores.
That's right, yeah. And I try and see it through their eyes. My books have a wide palette, a whole bunch of characters, different points of view, and, different races and classes, all that. I feel like I'm just writing social documents that have crime elements.
As we can hear from the reading, your characters are always making reference to what they're listening to or what movies they're seeing. Mm-hmm. There's always a musical backdrop to what's going on in the story. Tell me why that's so important to you, to put that in.
It was vital in my life. Music was just one of the pop culture elements that got me motivated to do what I'm doing now. And I think in these people's lives, it's also vital. The settings that I put them in, whether it's a sales floor or a kitchen, for example, or just driving around in a car, there always would be the radio on. And what they're listening to in many cases defines their characters.
Do you mostly choose records you like for your characters to be listening to?
I try not to. I think maybe in the beginning I did, and now I'm getting away from that. There was the danger of having a list of things that I'm listening to at the time in my books, And I think I've gotten away from that. Although, you know, in a book like King Sucker Man, it's a way to celebrate my love of 70s funk, which I think is the funk and soul movement of the 70s is the most glorious American music movement, in my opinion, you know, in this post-war period.
You have two different series. One is your series about Nick Stefanos, an appliance store salesman, you know, a stereo salesman turned private eye, who is also a bartender. And the other is your King Sucker Man series. Would you tell us some of the differences between those two?
The Nick Stefanos books were our first-person hard-boiled detective novels. And Nick Stefanos started out being a character, there's no denying, that was very much autobiographical. I was a guy who worked those sales floors, for example, and I burned all that down in the attempt to change my life and become a writer. He burns it behind him as well and becomes a private detective. Where he differs from me is that, and what interested me about the series was that I was trying to create a character that changed in every book. And I was tired of having the reformed alcoholic private detective. And I thought, well, what about a guy who gets worse in every book? His problem,
that's right,
right,
he does, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's going towards this, he's slipping towards this private hell further and further in every book. And he's, you know, the idea is that he is not able to help himself. However, he's very much able to help the community that he lives in.
And the King Sucker Man series.
Right, that started actually with The Big Blowdown, which is my book set in the 40s in D.C. It's about Greek immigrants and other immigrants in the city, and it starts in the Depression, goes through the war, and into the post-war years. And when I'd finished that, I started wondering, well, what happens to the kid, the baby in that book, who's the son of the protagonist, Peter Karras? And I thought, you know, what's really interesting is that these guys in The Big Blowdown wouldn't even leave the house without a fedora, a tight Windsor knot, an overcoat. What about the son, you know, in 1976? What would he look like? Well, of course, I knew because I was there. And what he would look like is a guy wearing ripped jeans, having, you know, shoulder-length hair, and selling dope. And the radical cultural shift was what interested me, and that's how I got onto King Sucker Man.
Your book, King Sucker Man, was set in the 70s, and your new book, The Sweet Forever, is set in the 80s. And I'm wondering if part of the reason why you wanted to go back to those decades is those are the decades when you were young and probably listening to music even more than you have a chance to listen to it now.
That's right. Well, I already said about the 70s, what it meant to me, the music then. And I was in 76 when that book is set, King Sucker Man. I was out there on the street. I was 19 years old. It was my summer, as every man has a summer that he remembers more than any other. I barely did any research for that book. I can still remember what we were wearing. I can remember the way the city smelled, what was coming from the radios, all of that. 86, I set the book in 86, The Sweet Forever, because it was a pivotal summer in Washington history. And by that, I mean several things happened. Crack came to town and changed the landscape. As we know it, the crime accelerated tenfold. It was also the summer that we in Washington, the citizens, began to get a pretty good idea of the level of corruption in our public government there, the local government.
In what ways was the summer that you turned 19 your summer?
I was becoming a man, and I was you know, jumping out of the nest. I ran my dad's carryout shop downtown for half the year because my father had gotten sick, and I had dropped out of college, actually, to do that. When you're in business like my parents were, you have your own business, there's no insurance, so I had to step in and do that for my family.
This is like a diner that sold takeout food?
Yeah, and it was a lunch counter, 27 seats, a couple booths. And then after the bicentennial, which I was down there like everybody else, I took off in my 70 Camaro with my buddy Steve Radis, and we went all over the South. We did that, you know, that Huck Finn thing. And I came back, and for the rest of the year, I sold televisions and stereos in a place called Landover in outside of Washington, which was an all-black neighborhood. And it was just a very memorable year for me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is crime writer George Pelicanos, and his new book is called The Sweet Forever. Now, King Sucker Man, the title of your previous book, is the name that you've given to a blaxploitation film that you created for the novel, and it stars Ron St. John. And it has a theme with the lyric. Do you want to recite the lyric?
King Sucker Man, running down the master plan, taking it right to the man.
Right. Now, what did the black exploitation films, the black action films, what effect did they have on you in the 70s?
It was huge. I saw Shaft at the Town Theater down on 13th in New York. My dad took me to it when I was 13 years old. And from then on, I went to every movie I could. I'd go into the inner city. I'd take a bus downtown, or I'd go to the drive-ins when we were old enough to drive. And it was my looking glass into another world. I knew that it wasn't realistic, and everybody was having fun. But it was cool for me, and also especially for black people, to see a black protagonist who wins for a change and who has an attitude to boot.
Now, your novel, King Sucker Man, opens at a drive-in, which is showing Black Caesar, which is one of the black action films of the 70s. Mm-hmm. And there is a shooting at the drive-in that is timed to coincide with a shooting in the movie so that no one will hear the real gunshots, because it'll be covered by the gunshots on screen.
That's right.
What are some of the differences you would like to show between movie violence and real violence in your books?
Yeah, I think that's the whole intersection of King Sucker Man, where they go to the movie theater to see this film that they've been anticipating for weeks. All the characters, the bad and the good guys, go down there. And what's on screen is a lot different than what they thought they were going to see. What they actually see is what happens to a real pimp. And the guy ends up in jail dying of tertiary syphilis at the end of the scene. And when the lights go up, they're stunned. But what I was trying to say is that, and of course, as the book progresses from there on in, the violence of the street, the real violence, intrudes upon their lives in a very real way. So I was trying to show that it's not real up on screen. And every time somebody dies in one of my books, yes, it's very graphic. It's graphic for a reason. I want to show people how horrible it is. I want to shake them up. And I want to remind them that it's not a quip, you know, those James Bond quips, bon appetit, when the guy falls in the shark tank. Well, that's a real person who fell in that shark tank. And I want to show what it looks like, because it's a very horrible thing.
I think one of the ways you know about real violence is from an experience you wish you never had, an accidental shooting when you were younger. Would it be okay to talk about what happened?
There's actually nothing extraordinary about it. You read these stories in the paper every week. It was, a gun was in the house. I was 16 years old. I was screwing around with a friend, and I shot my friend. The only thing that I do want to say about that is, because I won't talk about it, because I don't want to exploit it, but I do want to say that to anybody that's listening, especially young people, this is not a case of, well, Pelican has shot some dude. He's a hardcore guy, or he's hard-boiled, or whatever. I was just a stupid kid. And anybody can pull the trigger on a gun. It doesn't take a tough guy. That's not me, you know? It was a very, you're right, it informs everything that I write, I would say. And it changed the way I look at things. I think that the guns have to come off the street. That's why it is in a way why everything is so real in my books. Everything is informed by that one experience I had and then on.
Did your friend survive?
Yes.
Did you stay friends?
I baptized his child. I just saw him last week. He's got a beautiful family, very successful man. Yeah, we're still best friends.
You're very anti-gun now. Did your father get rid of his gun after your accidental shooting?
Yes, he did.
Where was your friend shot?
I shot him in the face.
You don't want people to think, oh, he's cool, he's tough, he shot someone, he's a bad guy.
That's right.
What impact did it have on you? I mean, it didn't make you feel tough, I imagine. What did it make you feel like when this happened? What effect did it have on you emotionally?
It rocked my world. I mean, it was a horrible, first of all, it was a horrible thing to see. I blew the whole side of this kid's face off at point blank range. And if your whole experience with guns had been through the movies and television images, you have no idea what it looks like to do something like that. The amount of blood that was in the house was splattered all over the walls. It was shooting out of his neck. And my dad came home with the groceries in his arms, and he walked into the foyer, and he just dropped the bags right out of his hand. Tears came to his eyes. You know, so... but I wasn't smart enough to totally clean up my act, I'll tell you that. I was still 16 years old, so I still, you know, did all the stupid things that kids do. I was... out there, you know, driving around with too much beer inside of me and all that, and all the stupid things that kids do. It took me a long time to wake up.
George Pelicanos is my guest, and he's a crime novelist. His new book is called The Sweet Forever. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is
Thanks.
Fresh Air. My guest is George Pelicanos. He writes crime novels. He's also a film producer. His new novel is called A Firing Offense, and it's a sequel to his previous book, King Sucker Man. I'd like you to read a scene from your first novel, A Firing Offense. And this is a kind of violent climax of the novel. I would imagine it's the first scene like it that you wrote, or at least the first violent scene of yours that was published. Maybe you could read this for us and then tell us a little more about what you think about when you write these violent eruptions.
He began to raise his gun from his side. He must have crouched down into a shooting position just as I squeezed the trigger. The slug tore into him above his shirt collar on the Adam's apple. A small puff of white smoke and some fluid shot away from his neck as he was blown back to the floor. Wayne squeezed a round off into the head of the South Carolinian. His scalp lifted and his forehead came apart like an August peach. Then Wayne moved his gun to the face of the man's startled partner and shot him twice at close range. As he fell back, I saw a nickel-sized spot steaming above the bridge of his nose. His mouth was moving as he went down, but he was dead before he hit the ground. Malone had shot the albino twice in the chest. The tall man stumbled and, still standing, pumped off two loads in succession from his shotgun. Malone screamed. In my side vision, I saw him falling backwards in a V, still firing. The albino was tripping forward. I emptied two more rounds into his long torso. The dreadlocked buyer was spinning slowly from the rapid fire of Wayne's automatic. The second buyer raised his gun in my direction. I screamed Tony's name. I saw fire spitting down from above. I covered my face with my arms. There was a sound of ripping cardboard, splintering wood, and concrete ricochet. Glass exploded around me, and I went to my knees.
Is there anything in this scene that came directly from memories that you couldn't get out of your mind?
I think you only have to see it once to remember it always. And people like emergency room technicians, I'm sure, are haunted by this their entire lives. And I would say that it's never going to leave my subconscious, and it finds its way into these scenes consistently. It was pointed out to me that a lot of the people that get shot in my books get shot in the face. And I didn't realize I was doing it, to tell you the truth. But yeah, it's there.
Do you think it's possible to write crime novels or make crime movies that don't, in the long run, glamorize crime in some way?
Yes, I do, by showing, making it as emotionally powerful as you can, and by showing that every life lost has an impact, not just on the loss of that particular life, but it reverberates into all the people around that person. And to draw the characters as people, not as types, so that when they do die, the reader's lost something as well.
Where do you have to go, both emotionally and technically, as a writer, in order to write these scenes and write them well?
Technically, I go up into a little office in the loft of my bungalow at home, and my sons sleep up there. And I have three children, and there's a lot of noise around the house and confusion. I've actually, for some reason, it helps me. I've been able to write several books like that. But when I'm sitting in that room, looking into that computer terminal, it's like being in a tunnel. You know, there's nothing going on around me. It's just me connected to that, and I'm playing out all these scenes in my head, and I can hear the characters speaking.
Do you think that your writing of violent scenes has changed in the years that you've been writing novels?
I don't think so. I mean, The Sweet Forever ends in an almost apocalyptic descent into hell in the drug house where the two cops walk into. The firelight is strobing into the room, and the faces are distorted. In fact, the the head guy looks like a gargoyle almost in that light. It's a frightening scene. It's almost veers into the horror novel genre. And I wanted to give it that nightmarish quality. I always do. The one thing you'll never see in my books is anybody making any kind of humorous reference to violence or death.
George Pelicanos will be back in the second half of the show. His new novel is The Sweet Forever. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with crime novelist George Pelicanos. His private eyes have worked in audio and record stores, and his characters see the world through music, movies, TV shows, and books. Pelicanos has a new novel called The Sweet Forever. It's a sequel to last year's novel King Sucker Man, which has just come out in paperback. An earlier Pelicanos novel, Nick's Trip, has also just come out in paper. Now, you used to work in an audio store selling stereo components and other things. How did you get from there into becoming a writer? Now, I know you also attended bar. I'm not exactly sure what the sequence is. But was there, you know, a straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, and got you from that kind of 9-to-5 life into being a writer?
Well, you have to go back to college.
Let me correct myself. No bartender is probably a 9-to-5 guy, but
that's right. I actually did a variety of things. I worked in kitchens and bars and a lot of sales floors. I put myself through college selling shoes on straight commission. Drove a truck for a while. But when I got into college, I was turned on to the genre by a professor named Charles Misch. And I wasn't even a reader, really. I hadn't read a book since I was a kid, probably, except for the ones that were pushed on me in high school. But I saw this guy standing up here, this very tough man and very smart man, literate, who was holding these books up lovingly and kind of stalking the aisles. And I just fell in love with the genre. So for a while I was doing these jobs for the next 10 years, I was reading 2 or 3 books a week, everything I could get my hands on. And like everybody else in the 80s, I was promoted very quickly, and by the time I was 30 years old, I was running a $30 million retail company in Washington. And I hated it. And so I sat down with my wife, and we didn't have kids at the time, and I said, "Emily, look, I want to try this thing. I think I can write a book." And she bit down hard, and she said, "Well, go ahead if that's what you want to do." So I tried it, and literally I did not know what I was doing. I'd never had a writing class. It was all based on books I had read. I thought, well, maybe I can do this thing. So I wrote the book in longhand in some notebooks in the back of my house and wrote it 3 times like that, and I sent it off to St. Martin's Press because I thought that they did mysteries. They did a lot of mysteries, it looked like, and I sent it to one publisher. I was very naive. I said, "I'm going to wait and see what this guy says up there." In the meantime, I started another book. Well, it took them a year to get back to me. They picked it up off the slush pile. The guy called me, Gordon Van Gelder, a young editor there, and he said that they wanted to buy the book. I was walking on air, man. It was the greatest day of my life, except for the day my first son was born. I was on my way then.
Now, when you were growing up, your father had a takeout shop, a coffee shop in Washington, D.C., and I know you worked in that for a while.
Yep.
Did that seem to you like a neat thing to have? Was it like a meeting place for people?
Definitely. It was right in the. It was next to the Palm Restaurant, which is a famous restaurant in Washington, and right in the district of the law firms. And I started out working for my dad when I was 10 years old. I'd take the bus downtown, transfer to a crosstown bus, and then I delivered food out on the streets for him. I delivered to offices. And it was the first time that I really started falling in love with the city and the people in it, because I was out there all day long running around. And I was very proud of my dad. My dad loved what he was doing. It's very important, I think, for a man to enjoy what he does every day. And I got that from him. And I also got his work ethic. I saw my father getting up at 4:30 every morning. I'd wake up and I'd hear him walking down the stairs. And he'd get home at 7 at night. And, you know, the man worked a full day. And he loved doing what he was doing. I'm doing that now. I work 2 jobs to this day. I run a film company during the day, a film production company, and I write at night. So I'm putting in my 14 hours a day, just like my dad did, and digging it. You know, I can't wait to get to both of my jobs. And I think you can't be any more fortunate than that.
One of the things you are often writing about now is race, and you often team up an African-American and a white character. In your new novel, there's two cops, one black, one white, and then two guys at the record store. The African-American owns the store, and the worker who he's close to is white.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the issues you'd like to address about race in your novels?
Well, the thing about the friendship between the two guys was that in 76, it was much more possible to have that kind of friendship. I think it's harder these days. It seems like it is.
Why does it seem that way to you?
Well, first of all, the reason it was easier then is because we were all coming out of the civil rights thing as young people, and it was like a rain had cleared the street, and we were all very interested in checking the other guy out, checking out his music, going to the parties. We all thought that things were going to get better then for everybody. Well, they didn't get better for everybody. And the fact that people have realized that has made it a lot harder to be interested in exploring those friendships today. As the father of two mixed-race sons, I'm very concerned with where we're going race-wise in this country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Pelicanos, and he's the author of several crime novels, including A Firing Offense, King Sucker Man, and his new novel, The Sweet Forever. In addition to writing, you also run a film production company called Circle Films. The films you've released include the first four Coen brother films, including Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Barton Fink. You were one of the producers of the new movie, Whatever. What else have you done?
We've got a picture called Blackmail that we just completed that I'm going to sell shortly to a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
We did a film called Caught, directed by Robert M. Young, and Bob Young is one of the fathers of independent film. That came out a couple years ago. And we're just doing small films out of Washington in a very quiet way. I'm partnered with Jim and Ted Pettis in Washington, and these guys are legends in D.C. They started the Circle Theater, which was kind of where everybody in Washington got their film education. So, you know, we're just trying to make good films in a very low-key way and hopefully stay afloat like that.
When I was reading your new novel, I kept thinking, oh, this is going to be a movie.
Yeah.
Is it going to be a movie?
Actually, King Sucker Man just sold to Dimension, which is a division of Miramax.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just turned in the second draft of the screenplay, so I'm writing it. And I think, you know, that one should be out. If they do it right, it's going to be out July 4th of next year because it's set during the bicentennial. It's a good way to market it, right?
What was the transition like from the novel to the screenplay?
It was difficult because you have to throw out all the internal dialogue. And you have to create more movie moments. But
what's a movie moment?
Well, I think more explosions, let's just say, in the metaphorical sense.
Well, we'll stop right there because it's probably also in the literal sense. And for a guy who truly doesn't want to glamorize violence, how do you make that transition to more explosive things on screen without glamorizing the violence?
Again, to show it as a very horrible thing, first of all, and to get away from the showdown kind of aspects of things. You know, in other words, when people meet and there's something's going to happen, it happens very quickly. And there's a lot of blood. There's no talking. There's no romanticism or anything like that. And there is a way to do it. Yeah, there's a way to do it. I wouldn't exploit that. I just wouldn't do it.
You mentioned you have two sons who are of mixed race, so I assume that means that your wife is African American.
No.
Okay.
No, I have three children that are adopted. Two boys.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I have two sons from Brazil, and they're mixed race. And I have a beautiful baby girl from Guatemala, who's native Guatemalan. And I have this really beautiful, happy family that I'm very proud of. And I'm here to tell you that this, you know, you hear all about these people that don't want parents of one color to adopt children of another color. And they ought to come to my house because I dare anyone to find a place that's more full of love than my house. You know, when I look at my kids, I don't see anything but my kids. And they don't see a Greek dad or a blonde mom. You know, they just see their mom and dad. So it works.
I think it's kind of interesting that you've decided to have such a large family, only in the sense that we think of, you know, the hard-boiled writer as being, you know, the loner, not as, you know, the family man who... who, you know, has birth children and adopted children and
right.
goes out of his way to have more kids.
Yeah. We the second time I went down to Brazil for my son Peter, we saw a lot of hungry children all over the place. And I mean, you know, you're sitting there in a restaurant and they have these dividers up and all you see is these thin little arms reaching under the dividers. And I could say in a way that it radicalized me. I mean, at the time I was reading in the American newspapers about this so-called revolution that was going to take welfare away. And people don't realize what happens when you take away that safety net in a society because they really haven't seen hungry people. And when you see it, it changes the way you look at life. So my wife and I decided as long as we could do this, we would do it. And so far it's really working out. Believe me, we're getting the bulk of the benefit because I have great kids.
In an earlier novel of yours, one of the novels about Nick Stefanos, the private eye, he's investigating a teenager who's been killed. And he's going through the teenager's drawers. And everything is kind of neatly arranged. There's just kind of clothes in there. And there's actually no clues to the true identity of who this person was.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick Stefanos, the private eye, is thinking as a teenager, he always kept a shoebox in his dresser filled with those things that were most important to him. I figure you probably did that too. And I'm wondering, if so, what you kept in your shoebox.
I still have that shoebox. It's still in my dresser.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you have in it?
Oh, God, I got a baseball. You know, the baseball I had when I was a kid the whole time. I've got a badge that with my name in there and address where I grew up. It's a policeman's badge. You know, it's a fake. It's a toy. I've got all sorts of little things that my grandparents had given me when they'd go on a, you know, they took a boat to Greece and came back, and they gave me a pencil, a big pencil that said Olympia on it. And it's, I don't know why I keep that stuff. It kind of haunts you in a way, but it's also a connection. I've actually got a review that I wrote of my first book, which I wrote when I was 7 years old or 8 years old. It was called The Two Wars of Lieutenant Jeremy. And the book is gone now, of course. It was just a war novel, you know, based on my experiences in World War II. But I still have the reviews, which I wrote myself. That's, this kid can really write Time Magazine, you know. I'm not kidding.
So in some ways, although you had no clue that you wanted to write or that you could be a writer until you started writing after holding all these other jobs, you did have a clue.
Yeah. There was a seed of that. The whole thing with me was about writing is I never thought that it was something that, you know, a Greek boy from Washington, D.C. ever did. You know, I thought it was always waspy guys with suede patches on their elbows and smoking a pipe, that kind of thing. I just didn't think it was, something that I could do or that I was allowed to do. And then I said, well, why not write about my life, you know? It hadn't been done before. I mean, all the Washington books are about something else. So I explore those people's lives, and I was there, you know, and I think that's my niche.
One last question. Is it exciting for you to be making a movie now after producing movies for several years?
Yeah, it's a different experience. And I would be a liar to deny that it's a dream, you know, to see my name up there on the screen written by, you know. So it's a guess, man. Everything. Look, I'm having a lot of fun.
Well, George Pelicanos, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Pelicanos' new book is called The Sweet Forever. It's a sequel to King Suckerman, which has just been published in paperback. Also in paper are his novels in his earlier Private Eye series, including A Firing Offense, Down by the River Where the Dead Men Go, and Nick's Trip.